Thank you for joining me today for Geezers of Gear episode number 199. We're getting close to 200 here. So today's podcast is brought to you by Elation Professional. Elation offers its Stadium Trio for large-scale arena and stadium projects that require only the most brilliant luminaires. The Proteus Brutus, an LED wash FX light with up to 75,000 lumens of cutting power. The Proteus Excalibur, the brightest IP65 full-featured beam fixture on the market. And the Proteus Maximus, a 50,000 lumen LED profile luminaire with a complete FX system. And they all come equipped with Elation's proven IP65 Proteus protection. The Brutus, Excalibur, and Maximus, a powerhouse trio of compatible luminaires for maximum impact indoors or out. Check them out at elationlighting.com. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Mainlight. Looking for exceptional value and flexibility in your lighting rental needs? Mainlight, your trusted lighting rental partner, is now offering long-term leasing. You can now take advantage of up to 60% off rental list price with even greater discounts available after 52 weeks. With this attractive leasing option designed for a minimum term of 26 weeks, you'll find featured items from moving lights, leading consoles, truss, and LED inventory, allowing your company to stretch its capital expenditures even further. As a lighting rental partner, Mainlight combines the resources of a national company with the personal touch of a local provider. By consistently purchasing the latest technology in lighting truss and consoles, from the newest truss to a full array of lighting consoles, your lighting will have the tech it needs to reach peak performance. Mainlight also carry a robust inventory of IP65 rated fixtures, giving you a lighting solution for any outdoor show or venue come rain, wind, or shine. Visit mainlight.com and trust Mainlight for the gear you want. And finally, please visit coffeecult.com, coffee with a K, cult with a K.com, and search for Geezer's Grind. Everyone loves this coffee. I love this coffee. I just finished one right now, actually. And remember, all proceeds from Coffee Cult Geezer's Grind goes to Roby Backstage to support folks in our industry with medical or other needs. Thank you. I saw you jamming to that song.
I like the track. Thanks for grabbing that little image in the background. And one thing I did notice on this camera and on my camera in general is that my head is really fucking shiny. So
like, it's perfectly shaped, like, though. You have a perfectly shaped bald head.
And you need to flip the camera again. What the fuck?
God, I need it. A producer.
I hear that.
I need that. A producer. Camera options. That's Hang okay. on a second. We'll get this. We got this.
Okay. We're going to figure it out.
It says mirrored.
Nope.
It's backwards?
It's backwards.
The hell is going on here, mister? It's just never easy, is it?
Nope. Still.
Oh, I see why. Hang on a second. I got this. I can do this. I have the technology.
I'm going to keep bobbing back and forth until I match up with my image.
I'm trying to flip the wrong camera. That's why. Here we go.
Okay. Oh, yes.
You are now mirrored.
Okay.
But I can't do anything about your shiny head. I'm sorry.
No.
Actually,
no.
I probably could, you know.
That's on me. No. Next time I do one of these, I'm going to have to powder the fucking thing first. By the way, can I curse on your podcast?
You can curse all you want. You can do whatever you want. I'd prefer you keep your pants on, but... Hey, you know,
I'm not even going to stand up. You're going to get, you know, the bust.
Yeah.
The bust look.
You know, what's his name? Mr. Wonderful from Shark Tank. Have you ever seen any of his news things on like Facebook or anything? Even on Fox News, he does it. He wears like crazy, like beach shorts or boxer shorts. And then like a suit jacket and a shirt and tie on
that's
top,
a very
right?
that's a very COVID like Zoom business thing
but
to
he
do.
Does it all day every day. He sits in his like beach condo in Miami Beach in his like boxer shorts or whatever, but with a jacket and a shirt and tie. But he's got a camera somewhere else in the room that every once in a while he'll show you what he actually looks like, right?
Right.
So it's pretty funny.
Okay. He is Mr. Wonderful, very proud of himself.
Yeah. I mean, if I could sit in my underwear and pull it off, I probably would.
You kidding me? Of course.
So you mentioned the background shot. I stole it off your Facebook. I'm sorry.
But, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, I needed an EDC shot because we're going to talk about EDC and that one was there. This is a rendering though. It's not a photo.
It's a render.
It?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a render.
Yeah. Did it look like that?
Yeah. It looked just like it.
You didn't have any pictures.
Like, you know what? On the socials, I don't typically put pictures like on the post. I'll put them in the story.
Oh, okay.
But even my story, I tend to keep like, let's just say whimsical.
Whimsical. You want to keep people guessing.
I'm my own best audience. I like to make myself laugh. So
yeah. Well, I mean,
the story I keep loose in the post is just like, I like to put renders and a couple snapshots of some drawings just to kind of give an illustration of what we've done. I try to keep it, you know, very pro, but very light.
Yeah.
And not like a pat on the back, just more of like a informational portfolio kind of experience. Yeah.
No, I get it. I mean, you know me, I'm not one to brag, but
yeah.
You know what? Everyone uses socials now to promote their business and
yeah, of course,
as they should. I mean, it's, you know, you can only look at so many cat videos and dog pictures and whatever.
Well, I like dog pictures. I follow a lot of those. There is a balance though between like what's appropriate for marketing.
Yeah.
And what's just you know, tooting your horn. So you have to kind of find that line and try not to cross it. I mean, we all try to, you know, when you're promoting yourself or you're promoting your business, it is it's a blurry line. So you have to just do your best to kind of gauge your audience and not feel like a pontificating fool.
I completely understand and I agree with you. And, you know, I cross that line all the time with my son. As you know, when it comes to kids, those lines get really, really blurry, you know.
Correct.
But, you know, my son has a cool and interesting sport that people tend to, like, you know, if anybody's counting likes, which I'm not, I get way more likes on Jeremy posts than I do on my own. So people are more interested in my kid than they are in me. And I'm totally good with that, by the way. So,
And we are proud of our children.
We are proud of our children. And, you know,
and your boy's doing great. I see him. I see when you post and I think it's fantastic. What a cool sport.
Until you have to
pay for difficult, it. So difficult to get into. Well, listen, you know, my money withstanding, you know, money aside.
It's an unbelievable sport.
And if you have the opportunity to participate in it, something that you're passionate about and you're good at it, you are really in a very small category of human beings who get to experience that. So for him, I think it's amazing.
Well, somebody reached out to me today and yesterday on my podcast with Marshall Bissett, he asked me how Jeremy was doing in England and stuff. And I said, yeah, but he's, you know, I bought him this little tiny shitbox car and he keeps calling me going, Dad, the driver's here. I'm afraid to drive here. They're nuts. The drivers, cause you know, the roads are like 4 inches wide and you got to fit two cars down these tiny little roads with these huge hedges on both sides of the road. You've been there. And so like it freaked him out a little bit for the first while. And the guy who reached out to me today, he's like, you know, I actually laughed out loud hearing a race car driver saying he was scared of the roads in England, you know?
Right.
But hey, it's all what you're used to. You know, he like when he got his license, it was the weirdest thing, like driving street license.
Right.
Because, you know, he'd tailgate everybody thinking like he's in a race car. And I'm like, dude. Right. Old ladies in South Florida stop for no reason in the middle of the road with no traffic lights and nothing going on. They just stop and you can't follow that closely.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's a whole different rule set. But
you know what, though, I think a healthy fear of the roads is also will drive him to be more precise.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't have that, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, in that sport in particular, precision is obviously is a critical part of success.
It is. Yeah.
I had an opportunity right before COVID. I was doing a show in Los Angeles at the Novo Theater for a friend of mine. He was performing, and we're sitting in the green room before the show, and he gets a text message. He looks up, he goes, "You're not going to believe this." I go, "What's that?" He goes, "Lewis Hamilton and some of his friends want to come to the show tonight." I was like, crazy. Yeah. Amazing. So Lewis Hamilton came down to the show. They had a good time. He actually texted me in the middle of the show. He's like, can he come out to front of house and watch the show from there? I was like, of course he can. You know, just make sure you explain to him the rules, like keep your drinks away from the console, you know, just respect the workspace. But he came out with his friends. They had a good time. And at the end of the show, I was going backstage just to say goodbye to the guys. And the artist who was performing, you know, he and Lewis struck up a relationship, and to this day, they're very close. And he calls me over. He goes, "Steve, I want you to meet somebody." And I see him there, and he's got his mask on. You know, it's like kind of, it was COVID, I think, was just kind of about to
kick off. It was gone for everybody, but
to be honest,
Lewis,
I don't even remember, like, the whole time frame.
It's a blur. Yeah.
But I come over, and he was like, "Lewis, this is Steve. He's the designer, so-and-so." And, it's kind of a weird thing to say, but I've never had anyone shake my hand with such precision.
Oh, right? Really?
It, like, you kind of being exposed to the racing world, this guy took his hand out like he was firing a pistol, and I'm in camera, and it was like his hand was perfectly 12 and 6 o'clock. He had the perfect like grip right there, one pump, and then like he put it back in like a robot. Jeez. And my whole brain just went click, 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 click. I went, what the?
Well,
what was that?
Again, not to go off on this forever, but we got time. So, you know, my kid's racing in England right now from, like, I think he got there February, and he's there until the end of October. And right. So he lives in Silverstone, and Silverstone is sort of the mecca of racing in England. It's where, like, there's a track there, the Silverstone track. That's where they do the British Grand Prix. Right. But it's like really a mecca of racing. It's like maybe Indianapolis here in the US, but like times 100. But anyways, he goes every day to this place called iZone, which is a driver development and training facility. And like, he'll be there, and Red Bull will send drivers in, or Mercedes will send, cause they're all like across the street, like the Mercedes F1 factories across the street.
Man, that's cool.
And, the Aston Martin factories across the street, Red Bull's right up the road in Milton Keynes. And so, but like he'll go there first thing in the morning, they'll do meditation, then he'll do yoga, but it's like really intense yoga. Then he'll do driver simulating. And these driver sims are like, you know, $100,000, $200,000 simulators where it's a half a car. And then like three projectors in front of you covering your whole vision, right?
Yep.
And so anyways, he'll do that, and then he'll do some hardcore like weight training and physical training, and then he'll go back and do this session where he'll have to do qualifying on a track that he's never been to, like some really intense, made-up, almost impossible track, and he'll have to do a qualifying run while counting down from like 500 to zero in sevens. And so they're just fucking with your brain. Like they're trying to mess you up in all these weird different ways to, you know, it's like making you ride a bicycle really fast and throwing snowballs at your face while you do it or whatever. Right.
Just I love precision sports. And this is
crazy.
It's amazing.
Well, a 10th could make a difference between first and ninth, you know?
Yeah.
1/10 on a 2-minute lap, 1/10 of a second on a 2-minute lap could mean you go from first to ninth.
Yeah. And all the combinations you have to do on that, on your steering wheel, you know, basically that computer that controls everything. I mean, there's a million combos, right?
Boom, boom, boom. That's not even, you know, that's like what I'm talking about is where you enter the turn, where you hit your brakes, where you're off your brakes, where you enter the turn, where you're back on the gas, where you're, you know, all of those things. It's just,
everything counts. I can't do it.
Like, I can't do it. I mean,
of course not.
We'll go out and
you have to train.
We'll go out and play go-karts every once in a while. Right. And he beats me by laps. You know, he just completely makes me look stupid.
He's precise.
What he does. I see your daughter. Is she getting like officially into lighting, or does she just do that for fun at EDM shows?
No. My kids, when they come to shows, and you probably saw the video that I posted from Coachella, they just, you know, they've been exposed to it their whole lives. So it's not new to them. And, you know, the opportunity presents itself. I push them right in front of the desk.
That's awesome.
So they're both, I mean, my son's a musician, you know, like he's, you know, he's an anomaly, like that kind of musician, like next really? Level. But both of
What's
my kids
he play again?
Are super
I forget.
Creative. He's a sax player.
Sax. Right. Yeah. That's cool. So yeah. Are they set in a path or like, does
both of them highly creative. My daughter, is a sophomore at, Chapman University and my son is a junior at Agora High School.
Okay.
So, I'm not sure what their career path will be. You know, my daughter is, very much into like social justice and things like that. So we'll see if maybe there's a career in, I don't know, fundraising or politics or something like that. And my son, depends on, you know, what day, he's a very skilled musician. So he's back around into that. You know, I think the COVID years for everyone kind of hurt kids at that age, especially, you know, like the junior high school, even college years, it really damaged their paradigm and their understanding of,
you'll like this story. Really I had Doc McGee on my podcast and you know, Doc McGee, right?
Yeah.
Rock and roll manager.
Yeah.
And so, I was asking Doc about the music business these days. I said, what if my son was like a virtuoso musician, and you know, he really, this is all he wanted to do. He lived and slept and ate music and playing music. And he wanted that to be his career. I said, do I still send him down that path? And he said, well, let me ask you a question. And I said, what? And he said, is he any good? And I said, let's assume he's good. And he goes, well, I got to ask you that. And I said, why? And he said, because everybody thinks they're a bull rider till somebody opens the fucking gate.
Right. Exactly.
And I mean, it was a great line and I don't remember what he actually said about the music business, but I think he basically said, if he's good, he's going to find a way to make it a career. And it's not totally dissimilar to racing, except the difference in racing is it really is money. You know, it comes down to really rich people,
sponsorship,
really rich kids tend to get, there's only 20 seats in Formula One and every driver growing up from 7 years old wants to be an F1 driver.
Of course.
And there's only 20 seats and probably 10 or 12 of them are paid for by, you know, a billionaire dad or a billionaire.
And those vehicles cost what? $100 million.
Well, it's not even what the vehicle costs. It's what it costs to run that vehicle for a year. Like there was a Canadian, who's in it still, Lance Stroll. And we knew Lance Stroll and his family from karting. They're from Canada and they did a lot of karting down here in Palm Beach and stuff. And so Lance Stroll's father, the first year that he put him in F1, he paid $70 million for the seat. And then I think the second year he paid like $50 or $60 million again for the seat. The third year he bought Aston Martin, the company.
Right.
And so his son has a racing seat, right? He's a race car driver. And so I'm not saying Lance Stroll is terrible, but was he that much better than every other driver that was out there? Definitely not. You know, it comes down to the money at the end of the day. So
In that sport, it certainly does.
So it's different in music. In music, you can be a phenomenal musician. And at the end of the day, like, you know, I'm sure your connections can certainly help him get to a place.
Of course.
You know, a lot of friendships and relationships and stuff can connect him with the right people that can help him. And, you know, again, I'm sure for your son, it'll become, but for my son, like he doesn't have to be one of the 20 Formula One drivers. If he can make a living driving a car, a race car, somewhere, somehow, he'll do it. He'll go to Germany and drive GT cars, or he'll go to wherever, Japan, and drive Formula cars.
Amazing.
You know, he doesn't care. He just wants to
drive a race car.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
I think it's fantastic.
Cool. So
we'll see what happens with the kids.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean,
I'm trying not to push. We were he just performed actually at Lincoln Center last week.
Wow.
Like, his high school jazz band. He's the head he's the lead alto, right? So it's his section. Top 15 jazz bands in the nation just competed at a competition called essentially Ellington. So it's all Duke Ellington charts. And he won two awards.
You posted something on social media. Yeah, I saw that. I remember that now.
And Wynton Marsalis delivered the awards. Good. So that was pretty cool.
God, wow. That's incredible. See that?
It was pretty
cool. Pinch me stuff.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's incredible. No, I mean, you know, I wish my kid was a scholar and was, you know, going to music school and doing all those things. Like I put him on hockey skates. I'm Canadian. You know, I put him on hockey skates. I bought him drums. I bought him a guitar. I bought him a microphone. I put him in drum lessons. He started getting really tall. So I hired a retired NBA player to teach him how to shoot hoops. The guy finally came to me and goes, Marcel, you know, your kid's really tall and he's a nice kid and I don't mind taking your money, but he's terrible and he's got no passion towards this whatsoever. I mean, not every tall kid is going to be a basketball player, unfortunately. Yeah. And all he wanted
we all
do
have our
drive.
Own path. Yeah, and we try as parents to just kind of give them as much direction as possible and teach them to be good people, right?
Well, God knows that when you were a kid, your parents weren't thinking, hey, Steve, go hang out in the nightclubs until 6 o'clock in the morning and, you know, do crazy things and whatever. I'm sure it'll turn into an incredible career.
It was discouraged.
That's a nice way to put it.
That's a really nice way to put it. It was discouraged.
You know, I know some of your younger years and you know, you didn't take a direct path to lighting stardom, you know?
No, I've been telling people through the majority of my successful years that I've just capitalized on bad decisions. So hey, not suggested, not suggested.
What kind of car is that? That sounds pretty good.
That's a FedEx ground truck.
Oh, really? I thought it was like a Mustang or something.
No. We're receiving a delivery. We have so many jobs going on right now. So
really?
One of my guys is in the back just, you know, and FedEx has called me 4 times to make sure they're like, we've loaded the truck. Please make sure you're there. Like it was like that. Like I literally got 4 calls this morning. They started calling me at like 6:30 and I didn't sleep well last night. So I didn't answer. I'm like, who the fuck is calling me at 6:30 in the morning? Yeah. And then I listened to the voicemail. I was like, yeah, I already called you and told you 9:30 to 5:30. We're going to be in the office.
Mr. Lieberman, we've tried to deliver this 12 times.
Well, last week.
Yeah. Last week was a big one.
You know, so I have, four employees right now and a new guy starting, in like 3 weeks.
You only have four employees and you had to count them in your head?
Well, I've had some rotation and I have a new guy coming, right? So we'll be back to 5 in a few weeks. But two of the guys are currently WFH, right?
Yeah.
Which we all know what that means since COVID. Before I would have been like, what the fuck are you saying? And then the three of us that are here every day, we were all at EDC. So there was nobody here last week. You know, my wife's my business partner, and she comes in, she doesn't come in every day. And she has other, you know, responsibilities as well. So I'm like calling her. I'm like, babe, there's a delivery. The window's 10 to 1. I need you can please. She's like, oh my God. Okay. But this one, I can't have her receiving like 4 full pallets of moving lights.
Right. Yeah. That's a little tougher.
It's a bit much.
Yeah. So tell me about EDC. I mean, I've only seen what I've seen on the internet and stuff. I've seen like the guys from Pyrotechnico, they posted a whole bunch of really cool pictures, unlike yourself. And I mean, it's insane.
Again, it's the fine line.
But it's insane. Like to me, it's
a
way
lot.
Bigger than I ever remember it being. Like,
I mean, it's like 200,000 people a day for 3 days in a row. There's camping.
Wow.
And I want to say, I'm pulling some numbers out of my ass, so you know, don't hold me to this, but I think there's like 60 or 70,000 people camping, which means they basically get in on Thursday and they start the grind and they don't leave until Monday morning.
Where is it? Is it UNLV or?
It's at the Las Vegas Motor Speedway.
Oh, right. Of course.
So we're all the way at the north side, right next to Nellis Air Force Base.
Wow.
But the economic impact to the city of Las Vegas when that show rolls through is absolutely tremendous. It's probably the biggest thing that happens out of the year until Formula One comes to town.
Yeah, that's going to be just insane.
Which is the amount of money that gets spent at Formula One is next level. But EDC, I mean, every hotel room, every restaurant, you know, everything is jamming.
Yeah.
You know, and for us, EDC, this year happened to also be Insomniac's 30-year anniversary. So it was a big, kind of like a bigger celebration internally for them. Because it's a major milestone.
Yeah.
And for us, we designed three stages there. You know, I had staff and, just the coordination is, 7 or 8 months long of coordination from start to finish. And now we're really trying to get ahead. You know, we're already working on 2024.
Jesus.
For EDC Las Vegas, not including all the other shows.
But so, this had to be that much bigger than any other year, right?
It's a beast. You know, like Circuit Grounds, for instance. So this year we did Circuit Grounds. We do Neon Garden, which are our two stages that we do every year. And then and we also do Wasteland. And Wasteland, we design lighting and video. We're given the structure as to what it is. It's kind of like a bass music environment. Really cool space. Little out of, the musical genre is not really in my personal wheelhouse. But as a creative expression, the place it's really cool. You know, it's kind of like apocalyptic, like trucks, destroyed trucks on their side and that kind of stuff.
That's cool.
But Circuit Grounds, for instance, the money that is spent on Circuit Grounds 15 years ago was the budget for the whole show.
Really?
Right. And now there's 9 main stages, 4 art cars, all these little sub areas and, themed environments and pop-ups. And, I had dinner on Sunday night on site at a pop-up restaurant that was there it was like dinner theater, and it was absolutely fantastic.
Really?
Right? Yeah, it was so cool. And I didn't even know it was there. And I was just happened to be with some of my friends and colleagues, and they're like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm on break. They're like, come have dinner. I was like, cool. I think I will.
How many stages are there total?
There's 9 main stages. Well, not main, but there's 9 stages, actual stage environments. And then we have art cars, which are basically, rolling stages, and those get located into some places. And then there's some other little kind of like off-brand stages that's not big production, but like in some of the garage environments, there could be a stage, and then, one buried in a hole in the back over here. And then there's the campground stage. There's, to be honest, I can't even count.
But isn't it just a big blur of sound? Like, how do you have 9 big stages? And,
that is a fantastic question. And when it comes to audio, I know just enough to be dangerous, but not enough to ever consult or like be qualified as a sound person. So you would think that it would be an absolute mess. But when you're in the stage environment, the audio people who work on the show do a very good job of kind of delineating the different areas. Of course, when you're in kind of the ether in the middle, it's a cacophony of sounds. Like you're just like, what's going on? But it's not so overwhelming where you're like getting pummeled. You're still talking to somebody and you could hear maybe 2 or 3 different stages, but you're not standing in front of a stage. If you're in front of a stage, you're getting it.
Yeah. I know those guys from the PK Sound in Canada, they do a bunch of this stuff and they've got like those motorized line arrays where they can like make things move and change direction and stuff so that they can kind of really direct the sound where they want it and not where they don't want it.
And PK and the guy, first of all, they're such nice people over there.
Well, they're from Calgary. What do you expect, Steve?
I don't know anything about it.
I'm from Calgary. They're from Calgary. But,
keep it to yourself.
We're all good people. And Nickelback, they're from just outside of Calgary. So, all nice people, right? Oh, God.
The PK Sound guys and their team in general, they have a very solid relationship with Insomniac, business wise. And I think there's a lot of friendships that go back and forth. So it's a good working relationship because there's a comfort level there.
Right.
Personally, I don't deal with any of the audio companies short of if they're on one of our stages, we make sure that they're accommodated in their space and location. But there's not much conversation.
It just feels to me though, like I'm going to walk into this place and just feel like, get me out of here. Like almost epileptic when there's sound coming from every direction. And when I can hear 3 different kinds of music playing at the same time, it makes me crazy. I don't know. I just kind of go, let's go. But
you should come visit 1 year.
I will one day.
It's actually, it's sensory overload, but in a good way. It's a very positive energy kind of show.
Well, I'll tell you, when I saw the pictures,
not aggressive at all.
When I saw the pictures from this one last week, I would have loved to check it out. Like, I was looking at this going, wow, why don't I go to one of these things and just, if nothing else, see it? You know, I'm certainly not part of their, what you would call target audience, I guess, but.
No, but I mean, the age demographic is really, I mean, you'll see people older than you and I for sure.
Yeah.
Not a lot of them. And the percentage of VIPs now has really increased. So the VIP areas have really grown. And the audience.
I can't imagine what that kind of money is, because I've heard tickets are like $1,000 or something.
No, I think, to be honest, I'm not exactly sure, but I think a ticket's like $400 or $500.
Yeah.
Which, if you think about it, over the course of three days.
Yeah.
You get a lot of value for that.
Yeah.
If you're into that music,
it's a lot of entertainment.
Shows,
yeah.
It's a lot of entertainment.
But it's like not just the 10 music,
hours
right?
a day.
Like you're saying, it's the whole cultural.
There's
experience.
Carnival rides. Yeah. There's merch. There's whole shopping districts that they've set up. That with different merchandise with vendors, so you can walk through and go shopping in different stores for clothing, for jewelry, for artwork. Like
there's none of the like Woodstocky kind of problems with, you know, fights and people starting fires and massive drug overdoses, and I'm sure there's a little bit of Molly being taken, but shit happens.
It would be speculation if I if I answered that question,
I'd
be speculating. But to be honest, I don't know that I've ever seen a fight at that show.
Weird. Wow.
I'm not saying there hasn't been one. I've never seen one. In general, people are well behaved.
Yeah.
You know, outside of if they're going to hurt somebody, it's usually themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and not on purpose. It's usually just an inadvertent bad decision.
Is it still Jake Berry?
Yeah, Jake's still there.
Yeah. Wow. That's so cool.
I mean, we have a fantastic team of production people. And, you know, Jake being part of that is actually, we love having him there.
Yeah.
You know, he's a wealth of knowledge and he's a good friend to us and very supportive. There's a lot of times, even in my office, when we come up with an idea that maybe could be crossing a line as to whether or not it's feasible on multiple levels, right? I'll use Jake as a barometer.
Yeah.
So, hey, buddy, you got a minute? We want to get on a Zoom. I want to show you something and tell me if I'm absolutely out of my fucking mind.
Yeah.
Or do you think we can do this?
I would also assume that if you've got a problem with a vendor or you've got a problem with something like Jake putting his foot up somebody's ass probably gets some fairly quick action.
Some of the vendors, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the ones that are more in the rock and roll world, you know, some of the dance music vendors, while Jake is a legend and a stalwart in our industry, you know, maybe in the dance music world, they're like,
who's the old dude? Who's the old dude? Who brought the dad?
And then those of us who have been doing this for, you know, nearly three decades, we're like, it's fucking Jake Berry. You know,
no shit.
It's great having him. And he's a sweetheart. I absolutely adore him.
Yeah.
I absolutely adore the man. I'd do anything for him.
I wonder if he's got anything to do with F1. Cause you know, he's a big racing guy. Jake's really big on motorsports and particularly open wheel, like Formula
He probably one. Does. I haven't asked him about it. But.
Yeah, I wonder if he's got anything to do with the race because I'm sure there's a lot of production stuff going on for that.
You know, when that race is going on, he's also going to have his hands full with U2 over at the Sphere.
Of course, they're doing the residency there.
So when U2 does something, I mean, he's been with them since the
beginning
dawn of time.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah.
That's
Have you
show.
Ever heard his AC/DC story?
Which one?
Well, the beginning, like basically
not,
when
I'm
it all
sure.
started, when he was sitting in a pub and and there's a really funny story about him and Brian Johnson when Brian Johnson got the gig with AC/DC and borrowed 10 quid from Jake because he didn't have a way to get home. So he had to borrow 10 quid to take a taxi home from the
amazing.
Cause he went into the tryout and he only did it because he was across the street doing like a radio. I think he was doing like a jingle or something at a radio station across the street. And he heard about an opportunity to audition for this band across the street. So he went across the street and auditioned just, you know, for a pisser, like wasn't expecting anything. And then, you know, they heard him do one or two songs and they go, okay, you got the gig. And he's like, oh, all right. Well, anybody all got 10 quid so I can get home? You know, well, I think they went
to the
pub and got pissed first. And then he,
as they should,
borrowed 10. Yeah. 10
Brian was a great fit for AC/DC.
Yeah. Yeah. Is. still
is.
They're going to go out here soon at some point. They got to go soon.
But he's got some serious hearing issues, doesn't he?
No, but apparently it got better. You know, okay. Cosmo is very close with Brian because they live pretty close together. So Cosmo visits him a lot and he always kind of checks in and lets me know because we talk about racing because Brian's a big racing guy. But but yeah, apparently it got better and, you know, they did an album and they're going to tour. They're just in no hurry. You know, part of the band is dead and but they got a tour soon because, you know,
as most of the bands now from that era are. Quickly approaching retirement age. And if they're not, they're going to die on stage.
It's depressing.
Let's just say it's metaphorically.
Yeah. No, but it's depressing. It's like every week you're reading about one of my heroes dying, you know, it's like, man, not him. But I mean, when the Paul McCartneys and the Stones and Led Zeppelin, when they all start dying off, it's going to really be a sad day. It's going to be like, oh no, it's time to go. Time to check out. It's over. So other than EDC, like, are you just EDC now? Like, or EDC in clubs? But I mean, are you just electronic music? Are you doing
like dance music? I mean, that's where our passion is, right? So I've always, as long as you've known me since I was a little shit of a kid, right? In New York, I enjoy dance music. And that's the reason I got into this industry in the first place. Over the years, I have delved into other parts of the industry, you know, different segments. I did some rock and roll, you know, I've done some TV and film. And in the end, I keep sliding back into the gutter with my dance music friends. Yeah. And it's where I'm comfortable. It's where I really enjoy it. And back in the day, in the beginning of the career, nobody wanted to be in that world anyway. They thought it was, the shit end of the industry. And obviously now it's become a behemoth as far as size and scale of what we do and popularity amongst the younger audiences. And it's not the only part we do. Like on tomorrow, I'm actually on a flight to Chicago. We're doing a big reggaeton show in Grant Park, sold out 50,000 people, called Sueños. You know, it's like Carol G and other big artists, same producer who does Baja Beach Fest. And we do that down in Rosarito and they're fun shows. Yeah. Musically, I think the music's fantastic. Is it programmed on my, you know, in my car on my radio? No, it's not. I don't listen to reggaeton on my free time.
Yeah, I get it. Me neither.
But I like the presentation.
Yeah.
So I enjoy being at the show and seeing how these artists put their, you know, display their performance and also like a lot of the LDs and artists on the technical side who are producing the shows, I really like what they do. So we're giving them the tools, we're giving them the design, we go in and polish the rig, make sure it's all good. But the majority of them, as in most touring artists, you know, come with technical staff and their LDs really have it together for the most part. I would say, you know, percentage wise, I think it's actually higher than a lot of other segments.
Yeah. No, but I mean, you know, the fact that you've been able to become so wildly successful in dance music, EDM, even all the big, you know, let's face it, a high percentage of the mega clubs you're doing, you know, a lot of the big Vegas stuff, a lot of the big stuff all over the world, I think. But, you know, there's a lot to be said for staying in your lane and not trying to be everything to everyone and doing what you really enjoy doing and doing it well.
I agree. I appreciate the comments and I agree. You know, like we've all heard when we were younger, you can be a jack of all trades or a master of one, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think I'm a master of one. I'm improving and I think I'm better than just maybe one. But definitely not a jack of all. Right. Yeah. So, I was talking to somebody yesterday, you know, the main stage of EDC is a very theatrical experience. There's like these huge, beautiful kind of, statues, they're inflatables. And, you know, someone was asking me like, if I could do design like that, I was like, that's absolutely so far out of my wheelhouse. I can't do that at all. Like never done it. We're not going to start now. And I don't like learning on a client's dime. Yeah. It's just not what we do. What we do, you know, like in my heart, I'm techno and house music, and I like that edgy in your face. We're production designers. We do delve into, scenic elements, but even our scenic elements, when we go down that road, they're sharp, knife edge, aggressive types of elements. So I don't do the soft, ethereal, like Broadway show kind of stuff. That's just, it's just not
No,
my
I get it. I
personality.
get it. Big, bold, bright beams in your face, you know.
As a designer, as an artist, I think every designer and artist, whether it's a lighting designer or you're, an impressionist, whatever that you are, you have a style, and that's when you're doing artwork, you express yourself,
Yeah. No, it makes a huge amount of sense. I'm
Yeah.
all for it. I mean, believe me, it's I see too many guys where, like, I'll go see a show, and I don't really want to use examples because I hate calling people out, but
No,
I'll go see a
let's not
show
do
where
that.
it's, the guy's last show was like, something really super heavy, and this show is, something incredibly light and poppy, and they're using the same looks. Like, it's white flashing lights in your face, and it's like a really soft, And so, like, to me, sometimes if that's your character and that's who you are and that's your lane, sometimes you're better staying in it. But I don't think you're
Agreed.
limited like that. Like, I think you could go do Eurovision. You're a big show kind of guy, and not everybody looks at a big show and goes, well, it's the same thing. It's just scaled up a bit, And but I think you'd be a great designer for like a
I
Eurovision.
appreciate that. I have some philosophies that have kind of suited me and have suited the business model. And for the people that I surround myself with, whether they're an employee or just a third party contractor, that have kind of these philosophies have worked. And the philosophy is really like embrace your environment. We're not trying to, again, I love cliches. My old man gave them to me since I'm a kid. We're not trying to put a square peg in a round hole. We're trying to kind of see what works with the experience that we have, with the real estate in front of us, whatever, or the geometry or whatever we're working with, or the music style. All of these things have meaning, and all of them have to be interpreted visually, right? So it's not a one size fits all. White strobes in your face, that's not the body of a show. That's punctuation at the end of a sentence, right? So if I walk up to a show and the LD, whoever it is, whether it's dance music, rock and roll, hip hop, or reggaeton, if you're smashing me in the face with lights, I'm fucking leaving. It's very uncommon that I even stay when a guest LD comes on. I make sure that they're good. I look at them, I go, "Are you good? Great." And then I probably won't even see the first two notes of the first song.
So
I've turned around and I've left.
what's your role at EDC? Are you like the overall like lighting consultant, lighting designer?
I have three stages that I'm responsible for.
Okay.
So, and aside from producing drawings that we do, here in my office and distributing them to the client, and then they send them out to the field, and distribute them to the stage managers and to the vendors and things like that, we do coordination up until the show's built and executed. On top of that, we also staff it with LDs. For festival LDs. Now, there are some stages that are a little bit more heavy on guest LDs. So I know who we're putting when it comes to that because you have to be able to handle guys coming in, loading their show files, sharing presets, and making sure that they have an opportunity to put their best foot forward. So at EDC, at this most recent iteration last week, the three stages, I had six guys, myself included in that six. So me plus five. I was the LD on circuit grounds, and then I had one of my guys in my office was my assistant LD, and then another guy in my office was the LD on Neon Garden, and then I gave him a number two, and then I hired a colleague for my third stage, and I gave him a number two. These are 10, 12 hour, it's 10 hours straight of music, and we have to be there 2 hours before, and we stay till the end. I have no expectation that one human being can just stand there, not take a piss or go eat dinner or just be able to walk away from that for a minute without
There's no
somebody being able to
breaks in
cover it.
between music. It's just
Oh no.
nonstop.
Oh no. It's nonstop. One into the
Wow.
next. I
Oh, I
mean,
didn't know that.
we might have a 1 minute changeover because there's just like a blackout for a moment. But this is not like a, live music experience
Yeah,
where we're like
bands aren't changing sets and
we're not
stuff.
rolling risers on and off and you rotate out of the stage. we're going from one major headliner to another major headliner. So Circuit Grounds, you know, during our peaks, you know, we have 60 or 70,000 kids in front of that one stage.
Damn.
And, you know, we'll have three or four monster performers in a row. So they're not leaving.
Jesus.
But I'm rotating the staff through.
So are those people wearing diapers?
The audience or the LDs? Yeah,
all the audience in front of the stage.
I'd like to think we have enough bathrooms. There have been issues in the past, you know. Well, let's transition for a minute. So, like, speaking of that, Yuma at Coachella, you know, yeah. I think that this might be our 10th year at Yuma. And this year, 5,500 people. It's a fully enclosed tent, wood floors, air conditioned. It's essentially a monster nightclub. We even have a bar in there. When we first used to produce Yuma, it was the same thing. Like, you have to wait in line to get in. And if you're not in line at the right time for the headliners, you could be in line. I mean, I've seen the line go for, it looked like a mile. Like, yeah. You're just not getting in, unfortunately. Huh. But when we first started producing it, there were no bathrooms. And the people that caught on to that, they were pissing in garbage cans. And it became a real biohazard until yeah. We're like, okay, we need a bathroom area inside because there are people that post up and won't leave. You know, yeah. So the evolution of that, we learned real quick, like, okay, this is a real fucking problem, right? We can't have people, like, pissing on the floor.
Yeah, what gave you the clue? Was it the smell?
Yeah, well, the smell's a good clue.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I mean, there's no books written on these.
That, like, can really tell you what's going to happen in front of you. We could figure out what happened before, but you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Right.
So it's there. You know, you're hoping that you have enough experience when you're developing these environments to anticipate what's ahead of you. But, you know,
when do these things get too big, though? Like,
what's too big?
I don't know. Like, that's what I don't know. Like, when
I think everything's scalable with the right planning, you know, yeah. Like Las Vegas, actually, I thought it was very well run this year. And I've seen the show, like, I remember, you know, probably 10 years ago, driving back to the strip afterwards to get back to my hotel was a 2.5 hour ordeal. And yeah. I thought I was going to lose my mind. And, I mean, we stay much closer now, but I have friends that were on their way back that left at 5:30. They got home in an hour. Hmm. That's not terrible when 200,000 people are leaving a property.
I mean, it takes you that to get home from a hockey game or a basketball game or something.
The traffic pattern, they've managed the traffic pattern. You know, the municipalities are very involved. You know, Coachella is the same thing. If you leave Coachella at the end of the show, you're going to get into the melee. You know, it's going to if you have to go a mile, it could take you an hour.
Yeah, oh, that's so frustrating. You know, that's why I just park the car on the side of the road and walk.
Well, that's why at Coachella, I stay in an RV.
Yeah, that's like, smart. That's
the
smart.
Anxiety of having to go get in my car and drive back to my house afterwards
is
just
a
nightmare. So I just get in a golf cart and I drive back to my RV. You know, I have friends that we're all in the same area, crack a beer, relax for a little bit, go to sleep, wake up, do it again.
Is there a team though at like EDC, for example, like some sort of a, not security, but like a, like almost like a terrorism, you know, like somebody who's paying attention to those types of risks?
Oh, 100%. Of course, there's life safety and risk management. There's, you know, there's cameras everywhere that everyone is under observation.
Yeah.
They are highly, highly attentive.
Yeah.
To the well-being and safety of every human being on property.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a guy on my podcast once, I can't remember his name, but a British guy who was an expert in sort of counterterrorism for events and everything from, you know, air attacks to people putting stuff in the water or drinks or food or whatever, all kinds of things to, you know, guys shooting people out of windows of hotels, I guess. And it freaked me out. It made me never want to go to a crowded event ever again, you know, because I was like, what? They could do that?
I could understand that. I mean, even for us at Coachella, going from our RV lot back on property, because we're on property, but when you come and go from the RV lot, you have to go back and forth through security. And and there's dogs that sniff everything on the way in.
Yeah.
Everyone, doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah.
Everyone gets inspected. As it should be. 100%.
Yeah, that's
because even if you're not the sus, you know, like even if you're not the suspect who's trying to do something, maybe somebody put something in your golf cart and you don't know about it.
It just seems too easy. I mean, when you got 200,000 people in there a day and you got all this stuff going on, like it just seems like somebody in a little single engine plane full of some sort of explosive material could just kind of
zip. I fly right over the job site because I fly down to Coachella.
Yeah.
And I literally cross right over the property. I mean, I'm not getting low.
Yeah.
But I cross right over the
while top. The show's going on?
No, I don't fly in during the show.
Right. Yeah. That's crazy. That is crazy. That always, I don't know, it scares me a bit. But maybe I'm just
so
scared.
You don't go to shows ever?
I do. Not as much as I once did, but I do.
I hear you. I'm not working, I pretty much don't go if I'm not working.
I don't go that much either, but yeah. I mean, if there's a band I really want to see, like I'm really close to, I don't know if you know, well, you know Wellington. Didn't you have a sister or somebody who lived here? I thought you knew somebody.
Yeah, my parents live in West Palm Beach. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
My dad and my stepmother live in at Breakers West.
But But I mean, the venue's like literally, I don't know, a mile and a half from me or something. The shed here, Coral Sky Amphitheater or whatever it's called. Uh-huh. So, I mean, I go there quite often. Somebody will call me and say, hey, I'm in town next week. And if it's a band that I sort of half want to see and it's not just Dave Matthews again, I'll go check it out. But I'll get there after everyone's already parked, I'll get there. And then before they all leave, I'll leave, you know. So
yeah, I like that strategy.
I'm definitely not, you know, a gamer when it comes to shows anymore.
I don't like going through the melee and through the crowd. If I have to do that, I've lost interest.
Well, and I mean, imagine going as me when you don't have, you know, a laminate and all kinds of crazy access and going wherever you want. Like sometimes that's just not so fun, you know, so.
Agreed.
Whatever.
But it's fun for others. God bless them. But for those of us who've worked in it our whole lives, you know, like even if I am just going to a show, do I really want to just get in line and wait? Yeah. No, it's kind of the appeal of that has really been diminished.
What about the club stuff? Like, you know, I know you're keeping super busy on clubs, and do they just keep getting bigger and do the budgets just keep getting crazier or?
I mean, it depends on the market, right? So the market kind of drives what's required to be successful as a nightclub operator.
Yeah.
So if you want to operate in an A market, you need to evaluate what the other operators are doing and what your target audience is and, you know, what kind of music you'll be booking. There's a lot of competition in the marketplace. If you're going to get into dance music, the big players are in there. So yeah. Insomniac, Live Nation, AEG, Golden Voice, I mean, they book talent. And if you're going to try to open up in a marketplace with them, just know that, you know.
They're booking DJs now, huh?
Yeah, they all book DJs.
Oh, wow.
All of them. Now, DJs sell tickets. Yeah, DJs are big, big sellers.
Yeah.
All right. That's so wild. At the end of the day, you know, all of these artists, they're a product and you need products that can sell. And if you are a hard ticket promoter, producer, whether it's a band or it's a DJ, it's a hard ticket and you need to put 20,000 bodies into a shed, you need somebody who can do that.
Yeah.
And I don't know that promoters are particularly picky about that sort of stuff. Obviously, you know, getting back to staying in your lane, some are better at certain genres than others or more well-respected in those areas. But the big dogs are in there. It's not like 20 years ago when Live Nation didn't touch dance music. Live Nation's all up in dance music.
That's wild. So, you know? Like, when somebody approaches you to do a big club, you know, a mega club, a big budget club, are they saying, I want you to build a replica of the last big thing you did? Or is it always got to be something super fresh? Like they want the latest, most unique, different idea that's never been seen before?
I hope that they're not asking for a replica.
Yeah.
Because that's not really what we're interested in doing.
But I asked you that because like Meacham, I was talking to Meacham about this because, you know, everyone wants 11. Like just redo 11 for me. And it's just not, it doesn't work
I would lose interest in the venue or the client or the project.
Yeah.
And we don't pick projects like that. And we don't say yes to every project.
Yeah.
So it's got to be something that we believe in with a group of people that we want to be with, that we feel offer something in return aside from just finances. Yeah. Finances have to be there. We're a business. We have to keep the doors open. I have to pay for the software. I have to pay employees, mm-hmm. you know, and all the other things that go with operating a business. But if you're going to run a business based on creative, you know, it's creative. We want to be able to express ourselves. We want to be able to do our artwork, and we want to be able to have an opportunity to flourish in those environments. And if we're going to come up to a client, it's going to go, can you just replicate what you've done there? I would say, have a nice day.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Not for us. Though. That's cool.
Yeah. Hire somebody else. We're not your guy. Yeah. Right. And we're not interested in building clubs for those kinds of clients. But the clients that we do build clubs for, we are given a lot of latitude to, again, express ourselves creatively. But what drives that is the space, first and foremost, the interior design, the philosophy of what the building is. And then every design is going to be bespoke for the space, because there's, you know, unless we're just building, you know, nothing but square rooms, venues all have a personality, and we're trying to find what works best for that personality.
Yeah. What about from a gear standpoint? Are you like using the same brand every time, or are you really brand agnostic now, or?
Brand agnostic. I kind of like that. I like to say that I'm brand agnostic, and whilst
I know you have a lot of friends, you have friends at every moving company, for example.
You and I have been in this industry our entire life, right?
Yeah.
And of course, we have friends in this industry. This is, you spend just as much time, if not more time, with the people you work with than the people that you know in your family. Because this is our day to day, 5 days a week, right? A minimum of 40 hours, and we're way more than 40. So if I had the choice of apples to apples of working with a stranger or working with a friend, I'm going to go with the friend, because at the end of the day, you know, I only have so much time in a day.
Right.
And I want to be with people that I like, right? Or at least have a relationship.
That makes sense.
But as a designer, as someone who puts together properties and projects, my loyalty, first and foremost, is going to be to the client and to the project. So if Marcel sells brand X and you have a line there, and I'm trying, and you're like, I really want you to use this fixture, but the fixture doesn't necessarily work there, I'm not going to use
it. Sorry, dude. Yeah.
I can't. Like, I love you.
But we can still go play some golf.
We can have dinner. But I don't want to use the product.
These moving light companies have made it difficult for you, though, because they all basically have the same shit now. Like, they all have, you know, a wash, a profile, a spot, a beam, a this, a that.
That is correct.
Like, they all, and guess what? Like, I was talking to Marshall about this yesterday. Everything's good now. Like, even the cheap junk is good now, you know?
The cheap junk is acceptable. Right. There are different levels. Right.
And of course,
I think for someone who may be listening to this and trying to evaluate the delta between a fixture type A and B, and I really want to stay away from naming anybody, is that imagine going out and buying a really nice camera, but you just bought the body, and now you're trying to decide whether to put the $1,000 lens on it or the $100 lens on it. There is a major difference in glass and optics as to how that light comes through that lens and illustrates the picture you're trying to capture, or the $100 lens, which is, you know, maybe they didn't spend as much time grinding that glass out, right?
Yeah.
So there is a difference. What are you trying to get? And, you know, you talk about things like, we hear things like CRI all the time in our industry, and color temperature. And those two things in a combination, lumens or lux or foot candles, if you understand what all those things do and the math and how they relate to what you're trying to produce, they make a difference. If you don't know what you're looking at, then I guess, you know, just try to match the numbers up at least and keep the numbers the same across your fixture types instead of like, you know, being all over the place. But that means something also.
Yeah.
So understanding the quality of what the light is. Now, if you're just looking for, you know, an abundance of fixtures and you need 200 lamps in a room, you know, you're probably not going to go for the $7,000 a piece fixture. You're probably going to be looking in the $2,000 range, which puts you in a different category. But like you said, even now, the $2,000 class of fixtures
are pretty good.
Is of reasonable quality.
Yeah.
Does it focus and edge the same way a $7,000 light does? I can tell you without any uncertainty, it does not even fucking close come anywhere near it when it comes to standards and quality of projection and what you're going to see on the overall feel. Yeah,
you could walk into a room and see whether there's Robe fixtures or Ching Chow Lighting Company fixtures hanging in the ceiling. You could see that. The average guy buying a, you know, $1,000 bottle of vodka probably couldn't see that and wouldn't care.
You're right. Right. You're 100% correct. However, if I took that same customer, mm-hmm. I was going to say something else, but we took that same vodka customer and I put him in a demo room with the rest of us who are in the trade. And I said, here's the low end fixture and here's the high end fixture. And I start focusing them and he's going to go, oh, no shit. There's a big difference. Now, is he going to notice the difference if he's hammered on the dance floor and things like that? Does it matter there?
Yeah.
It depends. I don't know.
Hey, It matters to me.
I want to see good optics.
My point is that the lines are very blurred now between the best stuff and the medium stuff, call it.
I agree with you. And we use it all. It depends on the client. Like some clients, you know, we all want champagne and lobster, but sometimes you can only afford beer and hamburgers, right?
Yeah.
But we make sure that it's still a good hamburger.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's well said.
And you know, what's important as well is that the company that you're buying from supports whatever it is that they're going to sell you. So even if it's of lower quality, like I need the human resources that go with the company. So whatever brand it is, if you're not going to stand behind it, then
that's the differentiator. Like that's it. You know, if like, cause I think today products are as similar as they've ever been. And I've been in this industry a long time. You know, there was a huge gap in quality between all of the different brands back in the day. Today, they're all a lot more bunched in and it all comes down to who you have the relationship with and do you trust them when shit hits the fan, right? And that's what matters. Like all the lights work when they're working, but you know, when they break, who do you want to call? You know, who do you want to be on the phone with and who's going to take really good care of you?
And we do shows. We don't do shows Monday through Friday from 9 to 5. That's not when we're doing shows. That's not when they break. They break on Saturday at 10 p.m.
Yeah.
So if I call you on Saturday at 10 p.m., do you answer the phone on Saturday at 10 p.m. or do I get a, well, you're not tech support.
I'm letting you know. I don't. Yeah. I'm not answering.
Right. I'd probably push you into voicemail also. Yeah. But that means something. If you call, if you're using software to run a show and they don't have tech support during showtime, what the fuck?
Speaking of which, what's your console choice? Are you MA or?
I've been MA for quite some time. You know, for moving lights and, you know, shows, MA has, that's been our go-to.
And for clubs as well?
Yeah, for clubs too.
Yeah.
You know, so now, you know, like the MA hardware.
That blows me away, by the way. Sorry to interrupt, but that blows me away that like when I was doing clubs 30 years ago, you guys have a bigger budget now for the console than I had for the whole club.
Well, that's not because we want to spend more on the console. That's because they've driven the fucking price up to where that's just what it is.
No, but I'm saying I was lucky if I got a $50,000-$60,000 lighting budget for the whole club.
Absolutely.
Right? And now you're spending $60,000-$70,000 on a console sometimes, most of the time.
That's accurate. You know, and the thing is, you know, when I have a client that's has questions or concerns about the cost of controls, it's relatable, and I understand why they ask these questions. And the unfortunate circumstances, this is what they cost. Yeah. But going back to like what Jeremy does, right? You can't put your boy in a beautiful car and put a 4-cylinder in it. It's not going to do anything.
Actually, I think his car now is a 4-cylinder.
Okay.
I think it's a turbocharged 4-cylinder.
Bad example. But you can't put a shit engine inside what you're building to be as a rocket ship, right?
Right.
That console is driving everything. So you can have a really good light show with really inexpensive fixtures like we just talked about with the best console, right? So like for us, we love MA. There's other great desks out there as well.
Yeah.
All because we don't use it doesn't mean it's not a fantastic console.
Yeah.
And I have relationships with the other manufacturers. They just, you know, I'm just committed.
Yeah. No, I mean, I see a lot
But it doesn't work the other way. You can have the best lights in the world with a shit console, and you can have a shit light show.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to have all the tools that you need to build what you want.
Or remember what we used to have to do to make a circle?
Yeah.
Like, that's what you tell young kids today who are standing at this console with all the macros and stuff, right? Like, you just go...
They don't have to program fuck all.
When I was your age, you know what I had to do to make a circle?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was crazy.
If you wanted it to look really nice, it was 8 steps. You know, you could, if you were in a rush, you could do 4 and just put a nice crossfade between them. But you had to know exactly where they went.
Yeah. Right? And you could get that going. I'll never forget when I first started with Trackman like 100 years ago, and we had to do this demo at Disney with RoboScan 1220s. Oh. And... And
were you using the Martin controller also?
I believe
or were
we
using the case.
No, I think it was the I think it was Peter Moore, and it was like a Martin 3032 or whatever the hell the thing was called back then, right?
God, that and hurts so, right.
So anyways,
here.
what the designer, and I can't remember who the designer was, but they said, okay, I want you to put the light up here in this corner on a white screen, by the way. Put it up in this corner and then move it down to this corner in a 4-second fade and then back again. And so we had the light going like this, going there and then going down, coming back up. And it was doing zigzags in between. We couldn't even do a diagonal line back and forth, right?
Yeah.
Without putting steps in the middle to make it do a straight line, you know?
Right.
And the engineers
just looking for the easiest path to go.
Like we'd go to the Danish engineers and we'd be like, guys, we need to be able to do a straight line. Disney wants it. And they're like, but why? why would you want a straight line? You know, all you're doing is moving the light to the other position. Well, as long as it gets there, who cares how, right?
For years, those were the same conversations. If you spoke to MA, we don't understand why you want this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so just understand. Sort of a weird European arrogance or something, right? I don't know.
I remember like when the Hog 2 first introduced their beta software that had an effects engine.
Yeah.
And it crashed the desk a lot.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think if you actually, so you could grab fixtures and you could hit like circle effect or whatever it would do, and it would start doing this. But if you hit the clear all button in the effects generator, the whole console would just literally just,
I think I remember talking to you before that. I don't remember if it was you, but I think it might have been you who told me that the Hog 2 changed your life. Like it took you from being a club lighting guy to being taken seriously as a, and maybe it wasn't you, but I thought that was you.
I mean, the Hog 2 was an influential part of my career. Actually, my failure at understanding how to use the Hog 2 changed my life, because that's when I actually learned how to program.
Yeah,
like I got fired from a really, really good job because I didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
Yeah, it was probably somebody else. Like somebody else told me that suddenly being a programmer was a job. It was like a career and you could actually charge like $300 a day to go out and be a programmer.
Right.
This is a long time ago, remember?
Yeah.
I don't even know what like.
I mean, if I didn't share that story, I mean, yeah, there are parallels for me. The Hog 2 was a critical part of my professional career.
Yeah.
For success and for failure.
Yeah.
And actually, my biggest failure in those early years was my greatest step forward to understanding how a lighting console is supposed to work and what a lighting system is supposed to be able and be capable of doing. Because before that, I didn't know, honestly, like, I didn't know fuck all, you know, like I've related to like, you know, obviously in the past 10 years, you know, I've become a pilot and, you know, when you first get your pilot's certificate, you get a private pilot. So you can only fly what's called VFR, which is visual flight rules. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, if you have the bandwidth to move forward, I got my instrument rating. Yeah. So your instrument rating changes everything from being a private pilot to being instrument rated pilot, or they're not even closely related to each other. And you realize once you get your instrument rated, your instrument rating, that is a VFR only private pilot, you're just a fucking monkey in an airplane.
Yeah.
Right. Literally. Like,
well said.
none of the other rules even apply to what you fucking do. But when you're instrument rated and you fly IFR, you know, just by the rules, forget even flying in weather, but just flying by the instrument rules and understanding clearances and approaches and, you know, arrivals and all those things, you're like, oh my God, what the fuck was I even doing before? I am actually a hazard in the sky.
Yeah.
And until you understand, you know, what the console's supposed to do and what your rig is supposed to do and what your show is supposed to do and how to kind of illustrate what your ideas are, you're just a fucking monkey behind a console.
Yeah. That's such a great comparison.
Yeah.
So on the flying thing.
Yeah.
Like, are you obsessed?
I am passionate. Yeah. Absolutely passionate. I love it.
But are you like going to go further?
Like as a,
like a
professional pilot?
No. As a guy with a plane, but
jets are
a
really
better
expensive.
Plane.
In aviation, plane. They say speed is money. How fast you want to go? And right now, I'm good at it, like 135 knots.
Yeah, so, yeah.
You know, I own my aircraft free and clear.
Yeah,
you know, it's still an expensive.
I'm
we'll
just
call
talking
it a
about
hobby,
the go further thing.
Work.
The go further thing. You know, what I mean?
Would love to. As a pilot, we all want to go faster.
Yeah.
I'm gonna wait till my younger one gets through college.
Yeah.
Before I go ahead, you know, because airplane, it's not like an extra 50 grand.
Yeah.
You know, it's hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
You know, you want to get in a jet, it's, you know,
yeah,
it's the Millions. Price of a nice, it's Millions. The price of a nice home.
Yeah.
So, and my wife's not really keen on flying. Although, you know, like if she said, if I had a pressurized jet, she would go, but she does not like going in my single engine piston. She doesn't
really.
I
love
that.
I love
my son goes with me all the time. My daughter on occasion. You know, we just I'm part of this program called Pilots in Paws, and we do animal rescues. So, you know, like maybe 3 weeks ago, my son and I rescued a dog and we flew it up to San Jose. So like we, you know,
that's super cool.
We like doing that kind of stuff. I love animals.
How far can you go without having to stop to refuel?
About 4 hours. But the better question is, how long do you want to sit in a little plane before you have to land and take a piss?
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah.
So that's the better question. I'm good. Like after 3 hours, I get a little antsy.
I gotta pay.
So it's not as how far can you go? It's I 3 hour flight is about, it's about my limitations on how long I want to sit there strapped to a seat.
I'm guessing in California, there's a lot of smaller airports where you can stop and take a piss and get back in the air within 20 minutes or something, right?
Actually, believe it or not, all over the United States, and I'm sure even in Canada too, there's little airports everywhere. And until you look at like a, you know, until you look at a chart and you're like, oh my God, I didn't realize there was an airport like 3 miles from my house, or like they're everywhere.
Yeah.
So even you know, when I took my son and we flew up north to, just reading something real quick.
No worries.
When we flew up north, afterwards, after we dropped the dog off, we wanted to stop for lunch, and there's this little airport right on the beach in the central coast in Pismo Beach, and it's like a 2,000-foot strip, literally no tower. It's in the dunes, and we landed. I was like, we'll just get fuel there, and we're gonna go get lunch, and then we'll fly home from there. So I land. Of course, the fuel pump doesn't work, and I was like, motherfucker, right? Yeah. So we got lunch, we came back, and then there's another airport that's maybe 15 miles. So we jumped in the plane, I took off, landed at the other airport, got fuel there, and then we flew home. You know, and there's five other airports within 40 miles.
Like 2 miles from me is the Aero Club. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's like
but
a little...
you probably live at it, right?
It's a little housing development, and you know, everyone's got their own little hangar, and there's a runway down the center, and... a lot of people fight to get the homes in there because fuel is like $2 a gallon cheaper than anywhere else.
Right.
And
yeah, they're
so,
called air parks, and they're awesome.
I
would live in one. My wife never would, so it won't happen.
Really? Huh.
Yeah.
Why not, though? Because, I mean, they're just the same as any other community. Like, Aero Club's beautiful.
Well, they're not as prevalent here. In Florida, there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
They're not prevalent in California, so they're a little more spread out, and... you know, still, if you're going to live there, you're an aviator, you know, and you're into it.
I have a friend who lives in the Aero Club and doesn't have a plane and just liked the house and got a good deal on it and, you know, didn't mind having planes flying over his head multiple times a day or whatever.
I would live in there because I like having a plane.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, but then you'd probably start getting plane envy, and next thing you know, you're spending those hundreds of thousands of dollars that you were talking about getting the
easily better,
faster planes. Yeah. For me, so, it would just be distance, you know, cause I'd want to, like, one of the things would be, I'd love to be able to get to my house in the mountains in Canada, but you know, now you're talking about thousands of miles, right? So you, with a little plane, it's just not doable. It's ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah.
But what's nice is, like, you know, during the winter, you know, I took my kids, you know, individually up to Big Bear, which isn't too far. You know, if there's no traffic, you can get from my house to Big Bear in probably a little over 3 hours, because you got to climb up the mountain. You got to get there. In the plane, it's an hour and 10 minutes. It's always an hour and 10 minutes, whether there's traffic or not. So I've taken them up on a Friday. You know, we'll go up at, we'll leave at 8 in the morning. You know, we're up there by 9:15, on the mountain by 10 o'clock. At you know, at 3 o'clock, we want to go home, and it's Friday afternoon in Los Angeles. And you can only imagine what that means traffic wise. You know, you're not getting home till 10 at least.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm home for dinner.
So where do you fly into in LA? Where do you keep your plane?
It's an airport called Camarillo.
Okay.
And so Camarillo is, it's Ventura County. It's about 18 miles from my house.
Oh, that's not bad.
I'm kind of right between, like, midway between Camarillo Airfield and Van Nuys.
Okay.
And Van Nuys is in the middle of the valley, and traffic and congested, and it's a busy airport. And I'm,
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, let's face it, you're just landing and taking off. It's not like you're looking for a place with a gym and you know, whatever. I mean,
well, my airport, I mean, there's a lot of high profile people at the airport. I mean, it's an airport, right? So if the runway is long enough, you know, there's very well-known people that keep their Gulfstreams and their Global Expresses there. They just built 4 private hangars, $25 million each.
Jesus.
They've sold 3 of them already to 3 very high-profile people. I could tell you when we're not recording who bought them.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think one's still for sale. So if you got $25 million burning a hole in your pocket, there's one
for
sale.
Hang on, let me check. I'm about $24,900,000 short.
Yeah, something like that. They're only about 100 yards from my hangar.
That's pretty cool.
It's a nice luxury to be able to enjoy. And I use it for work as well. So even for Electric Daisy Carnival, I went out on I think I went out on Tuesday, but I was running late and, you know, I had things to do. So I was at the office, and then I got to leave whenever I wanted to leave. So I was running late. I said I'd be there at a certain time. I was there a little later, pulled up, you know, pulled the plane out, and I go. Coming home, same thing. Like, if you drive out to Electric Daisy Carnival, you're going to get punished and you're going to get slapped into traffic. So where normally, you know, to go the 300 miles should be 4.5-5 hours, you know, it's probably an 8 or 9 hour drive. I was home in 2 hours.
That's awesome. Yeah, and that's a nice perk.
2 hours. Yeah.
So you always go to Vegas flying yourself, right?
Yeah. I mean, unless weather is a shit show.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, flying when it's super hot is uncomfortable, so you have to just time it right.
Yeah.
And general aviation, you need to make good decisions, right? So if you really 100% need to be there at a certain time, you should probably just fly commercial. You know, JetSuite X goes there, so just fly commercial. If you have a little bit of play in your schedule and weather or some other adversary, did I say it right?
Whatever. Adversity, shitty thing happens.
If some other adversity pops up, that you need to understand that could delay you.
Yeah.
Right?
That makes sense.
I got a flat tire once landing at Lindbergh Field, which is San Diego International. That was very inconvenient. They have no services there for general aviation. Mm. So my buddy, who's a mechanic, flew down the next day with a fully assembled wheel to replace my flat tire.
Huh. That's cool.
Yeah, except, you know, being at San Diego International is expensive. Yeah. So the next day when I came to pull my plane out, and I fly there all the time, they're like, sorry, we need to charge you for the next night of parking and ramp. I was like,
what's that
you
cost?
Guys are there, it's $50 a day.
Oh.
I was like, are you guys really sticking me for another $50? Because I got a fucking flat tire.
Yeah.
So like, we don't make the rules.
Yes, sir. Yeah, we are.
We sure are. But typically, like, if I fly to Vegas, like Henderson Airport, I pay $12 a night for parking.
Oh, that's nothing.
That's nothing.
A friend of mine here has a small plane, a single engine plane. And he, one day he called me up and said, "Hey, you want to go down to the Keys for lunch?" I said, "It's a bit of a drive, ain't it?" And he goes, "No, we'll fly down. It's, you know," I forget what it was, 30 minutes or 40 minutes or something. Right. And so we went down to Marathon. And again, there was nobody in the tower or anything. So it was like all visual, you know, making sure.
Yeah. And you talk to other pilots on a common,
We landed, he goes inside and like the guy inside hands him keys to a car.
Yeah. Crew
car. And we take this car out and we go to lunch and we go back. I'm like, this is pretty cool.
It's awesome. Hopefully, you know, he was nice enough to put like $10 in fuel in it or something.
I don't remember if we did or not.
Yeah. It's a nice courtesy, but yeah, we get crew cars. So if you go to an airport and they have like an FBO there, which is a fixed based operator that handles general aviation, they typically have crew cars, which is for pilots or crew. So you could go get lunch or, you know, go run some errands real quick, typically while you're waiting for passengers or just,
that's so cool.
You know, because you're there.
Yeah. It's so what do you got coming up?
Well, I'm going to Chicago next week. We just opened up a new club in Dallas for Groot Hospitality called Komodo. We're building, we have probably 10 or 12 nightclubs under development.
Damn.
You know, and just lots of shows that we're designing.
There's more EDCs too, right?
There's more EDCs. EDC Orlando is coming up at the end of the in the fall. We have EDC China coming back in the fall as well. We have Portola Festival up in NorCal for Golden Voice. We have a lot of techno shows locally for Framework, which is a big techno brand here in LA.
Nice.
We have Baja Beach Fest coming up in Rosarito, Mexico. Live nightclub at the Fountain Blue in Las Vegas, nightclub and day club. And, you know, we're doing some of the other properties there.
So you're kind of busy.
We're doing some clubs in Mexico and some big projects in Miami that, yeah. Thank God we're very grateful for the work and our clients. 90% of our clients are also friends and colleagues, people that we've just kind of come up through the business together. So it's still a job. It can grind you like any other job. So even last night I was working at home till probably 1 o'clock in the morning. My wife's like, "Why don't you give it a break?" I go, "Babe, if I'm not tired, I'm going to go lay in bed and think about all the work I have to do, or I could just fucking sit here and do it."
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. I don't always follow that philosophy. Sometimes I lay in bed and just stress out about all the work and just don't do anything.
I know. And, the program.
Yeah, last night I motivated and, banged out some design work. I actually got something modeled and a couple things sketched. So I was able to, like, prepare myself for the day.
Cool.
You know, and then 8 a.m. flight tomorrow. Back out. And then home for a couple weeks.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to do this, Steve. It's so cool to catch up with you. We keep
Aside from the podcast, it's great to actually dedicate some time to talk to an old friend and just kind of catch up. The fact that we've recorded it. You know, great.
But that's why I do this. The recording is secondary.
Yeah. If anybody listens, cool. If they don't, it was good to see my buddy.
By tomorrow at noon, you'll have about 400 people who have downloaded it. So
fantastic.
Remarkably. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, buddy.
It's nice to see the way it's grown. So congratulations.
Appreciate it.
On having the perseverance to produce this and engage with the people in our industry to just kind of chop it up and keep things, you know, keep the conversation alive.
If nothing else, I'm a stubborn bastard. So, you know,
right.
Yeah. I appreciate that.
We have that in common.
We do.
Yeah.
All right, buddy. Good to see you.
All the best.
See you later.
Bye.